welcome to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 26th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, Who's Behind PAX? Cedar Valley Backs the Blue, Cedar Falls Forward, and Cedar Valley Tomorrow? You've read about them, received a postcard, or seen a billboard. But who exactly is behind the political action committees backing issues and candidates in city elections in Waterloo and Cedar Falls? And what are they advocating for? Political action committees, just like candidates, have to register with the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board, which enforces the provisions of the Campaign Disclosure Act, the Government Ethics and Lobbying Act, and reporting of gifts and bequests received by agencies as outlined by the Iowa Code. Besides reporting the names and contact information of their officers, city PACs and candidates also must report their income and expenditures 5 days before the general election, which we'll report in a future Courier article closer to the election. Cedar Falls Forward, and this is a subheader, it says Committee Chairperson Mark Kittrell, Treasurer Maribeth Sonson, Account is Cedar Falls Forward Political Action Committee checking account at First Bank, and the purpose is community advocacy. And another kind of subheader says, read, Cedar Falls Forward PAC Statement of Organization. If you're a Cedar Falls resident, the first you may have heard of this PAC was the postcard mailed in mid-September, but the group has also been on Facebook since September, touting city employees, promoting upcoming council meetings, and supporting things like the Cedar River Master Plan. We feel like we represent the viewpoint of a large part of Cedar Falls, that Cedar Falls is a great town to live in and that we want to see its successful trajectory continue into the future, Kittrell and Sonson wrote in their response to Courier questions. The current community conversation isn't taking us in that direction. Kittrell runs real estate development firm Eagle View Partners, which developed River Place along State and East 2nd Streets in downtown Cedar Falls. He is a board member of the Iowa Economic Development Authority in Cedar Valley Tech Works and Millrace, according to his LinkedIn profile. Sonson runs Acorn Advisors Marketing, which offers content marketing to businesses specializing in kitchenware. She's also on the board of both Cedar Falls Utilities and First National Bank, according to her LinkedIn profile. The pair notes, the domination of a single issue was having a very strong negative impact, though they insist the PAC wasn't formed primarily to promote the city's public safety model, the first in the state intertwining police and fire departments. It drew the attention of Iowa legislature this year. Nevertheless, they plan additional communication in the coming weeks on what we've learned about the status of public safety in Cedar Falls. City Councilor and Mayoral Challenger Dave Sires of Ward 1, Challenger Gil Schultz of Ward 3, and Challenger Cara Bigelow-Baker of Ward 5, Challenger Justin Gainfield and at-large candidate T.J. Frein all support scrapping the PSO model and returning to separate police and fire departments. Rob Michael, who told the Courier that he was anti-PSO and planned to run in Ward 5, did not file to appear on the ballot. Kittrell and Sonson said they don't have a classical style of endorsement, preferring to put candidates' responses in their questionnaires sent out September 17th on their website in full. We don't want to be prescriptive in telling folks who to vote for, but we hope to provide valuable information that informs, they noted. And then it moves on to another subheader of Cedar Valley Backs the Blue, which is another political action committee. Committee chairperson is Lynn Moeller. Treasurer is Rhonda Weber. Account is Cedar Valley Backs the Blue checking account at Viridian Credit Union. And purpose is to elect pro-law enforcement candidates. Cedar Valley Backs the Blue statement of organization. With their prominent downtown billboards, robust Facebook presence, and occasional appearances at Waterloo City Council meetings, Cedar Valley Backs the Blue is probably the PAC with the most name recognition locally. Retired police officers Moeller and Weber started the PAC after a year-long process of retiring the decades-old Griffin logo from the Waterloo Police Department. This expensive and unnecessary attack by the mayor and city council has left many people scratching their heads, Moeller said in the group's first press release. To us, the only thing that needs rebranding is our local government. Moeller retired in 2010 after 35 years with the department as an investigator, according to a Courier article at the time. He was named the department's Officer of the Year in 1980. Weber was a member of the city's rebranding committee, tasked with designing a new WPD logo, and retired this summer. She was named Officer of the Month in October of 2018 by the Waterloo Police Protective Association. Weber and two other recently retired WPD officers publicly laid blame for moral issues within the department on Chief Joel Fitzgerald. In our opinion, change at the department is desperately needed and it needs to start at the top, the officers wrote in a Courier guest column in September. The PAC has publicly backed City Councilor Margaret Klein's mayoral bid, along with council challengers Mickey McCracken in Ward 1, Todd Maxton in Ward 3, Don Henry in Ward 5, and Dennis Halverson for the at-large seat. We couldn't be happier with the support we've received from the community, Moeller told the Courier last week. He noted the PAC has a few different things planned in terms of advertisements prior to the election, but like the billboards, it will be a surprise. Cedar Valley Tomorrow, this is another PAC. Committee chairperson is Josh Wilson. Treasurer slash account, there is none. And purpose is to advocate for slash against candidates, working to elect candidates with a strong vision for tomorrow. Cedar Valley's Tomorrow paid before by short form. Wilson was considering a run for the Cedar Falls Ward 1 seat held by Mark Miller when he filed the form for Cedar Valley Tomorrow, when he told the Courier. That form is for PACs that raise less than $1,000 but still require a paid-for-by language on campaign materials under Iowa code. I actually didn't raise any funds and only spent my personal dollars, Wilson said. Wilson said he conducted some very targeted phone polls in April when he was considering whether to run and spent well below $1,000 to do so. He said Miller's decision this spring to step down from the council changed his mind, and Cedar Valley Tomorrow has been inactive, though not dissolved, since May. Wilson, who was the public liaison for former Governor Terry Branstad and former communications director in the U.S. House of Representatives, is now a remote working publicist with Otter Public Relations. He also served on the board of Cedar Valley Hospice. Now, let's move on to the article, Waterloo Cedar Falls Schools to Determine Mask Mandates Based on County Elementary School Metrics. Mask requirements for elementary students in the Waterloo and Cedar Falls school districts will be decided based on county and individual school COVID-19 metrics, district officials announced Friday. Starting Monday, school officials in both districts will implement a system on masking that takes into consideration the Black Hawk County COVID-19 rate of spread and the percentage of students and staff at individual schools who are out due to COVID. Masks will be required for a week for students and staff at any elementary school when the county's rate of spread is moderate or high and the percentage of students and staff out with COVID is 3% or greater. Every Friday, we will communicate to each elementary building, staff, and families any adjustments to protocols, mitigation measures, and mask wearing that would be in effect the following week based on the matrix. Our goal is that a one-week mask requirement will help lower additional transmission of the virus and keep students learning in person, Waterloo Schools officials said in a news release. The release said the district has worked diligently behind the scenes to create metrics that will guide our decision-making around wearing masks due to COVID-19 as we move forward. WCSD has also continued to collaborate with the Cedar Falls Community School District to ensure alignment as much as possible, recognizing that some differences between the districts needs to also be considered. At Waterloo's middle and high schools, masks will continue to be strongly encouraged for all grade levels in the instructional setting and required on buses per federal law. In Cedar Falls, junior highs and high school will continue to operate as they have been since the start of the school year, a district official said in the news release. Officials said the matrix indicators they set forth for elementary schools are well below 10% state requirement for reporting illness to Black Hawk County Health Department, and it is a number that we feel is responsible based upon Waterloo School's data from last school year. We still strongly encourage face coverings for staff and students while indoors. District officials said further adjustment will be made as necessary if conditions related to COVID-19 drastically change in our schools, our classrooms, or the community, or if changes occur in the ongoing legal debate over school mask mandates. Additionally, Cedar Falls officials implored parents to please continue to keep your child home if they are not feeling well, as we work to remain with in-person learning during this pandemic. Now on to a similar article. Parents favoring mask mandates delivering petition to Cedar Falls School Board. Parents who want to see Cedar Valley schools follow the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's recommendations on mask usage have been organizing to make their voices heard. Parent Elise Dubord started collecting signatures on a petition calling for a mask mandate in Cedar Falls Community Schools after a federal judge signed a temporary restraining order September 13th, halting enforcement of a state law that didn't allow schools to require masks. "I started the petition for Cedar Falls, and we have over 300 people who have signed that already," said Dubord. "We know that masks are the best way to keep unvaccinated people safe. It's so reasonable, and to prevent it any other way is to deny the reality of what the science has told us. The CDC recommends that mask wearing at school as the Delta coronavirus variant is spreading rapidly in much of the country." After a week-long mask mandate for elementary schools was announced September 17th by the Waterloo and Cedar Falls school districts, residents who wanted to see that expanded to secondary students and made permanent started a Facebook group, Masks Make Sense in Cedar Falls/Waterloo Schools. More than 400 people have joined that group. "For me, a big part of it is I have two children in elementary school. They're not 12 years old, and they're not vaccinated," said Dubord. She noted that the talk about protecting people's freedom from those calling for mask use to be optional ignores that some children may have underlying medical conditions. That makes it unsafe for those children to be in school with others who are unvaccinated and not wearing a mask. They deserve to be in school," said Dubord. "We are incredibly pleased that they put a mask mandate in place, even though it's only for a week. However," she added, "I'm very disappointed that it isn't K-12 for the whole system." Both districts say masks are strongly encouraged for secondary students, most of whom are old enough to qualify for a vaccine. During the temporary mask mandate at the elementary level, the districts collected data on the effectiveness of face coverings in their schools while developing metrics for future use. Waterloo Schools Friday announced a metrics system in which masks will be required for students and staff at any Waterloo Elementary School when the county rate of spread is moderate or high and the percentage of students and staff out with COVID is 3% or greater. At Waterloo's middle and high schools, masks will continue to be strongly encouraged for all grade levels in the instructional setting and required on buses per federal law, according to a news release. "We've been encouraging people to write directly to the school board and superintendent, and also people who are preparing to speak at the school board both in Waterloo and Cedar Falls," said Dubord. "Both boards require people to make a notification by 4 p.m. if they want to speak during a public comment period of their meetings. For Waterloo schools, register with the board secretary Pam Arndorfer at arndorferp@waterlooschools.org or 319-433-1874. For Cedar Falls, contact Superintendent Andy Patti at 319-553-3000 or Board President Jeff Hassman to receive approval to speak. The Waterloo Board of Education meets at 5 p.m. in the Education Service Center at 1516 Washington Street, Waterloo. The Cedar Falls Board of Education meets at 5:30 p.m. in the Council Chambers of the Cedar Falls City Hall, 220 Clay Street. Now on to Iowa Oktoberfest welcomes fall in downtown Waterloo. German culture was on display this weekend as the third annual Iowa Oktoberfest filled Anton's Garden in downtown Waterloo with revelers. The free event Friday and Saturday featured popular German games, beer, and food for people of all ages. Among the activities were stein hoisting, keg races, and best bearded and best dressed contests. Dog owners were encouraged to bring their dressed up pooches for a parade on Saturday, with a best dressed trophy on the line. There was plenty to do for the kids with activities such as pumpkin painting, bags, and axe throwing. And German-American German and American beers run hand, with many festival goers opting for German brews on tap served in the customary Das Boot. And now on to the article, Senator Chuck Grassley announces he'll seek an eighth term. Senator Charles Grassley, Iowa's longest-serving U.S. senator, will seek re-election to an eighth term. Grassley, 88, a Butler County family farmer from New Hartford, made the announcement on Friday via Twitter. "Serving Iowans in the United States Senate is a tremendous honor," said Grassley. "I've been working as hard as ever for the people of Iowa, and there's more work to do. In a time of crisis and polarization, Iowa needs a strong, effective leadership. I'm focused on serving the people of Iowa as your senator and fighting for policies that will make Iowa an even better place to raise a family and grow a business." Grassley spent part of Friday afternoon at the National Cattle Congress Fair in Waterloo. He recalled getting the day off from school in New Hartford as a child to attend the fair. He toured the grounds and the cattle barn with the NCC general manager, Jim Koch. "I enjoy being here and seeing the cattle," Grassley said. Grassley took his time making up his mind on whether to run for an eighth term, but with his family on board and hearing encouragements from constituents, those doubts went away, he said. "You get the comments like, 'I hope you run again. We need your common sense in Washington.' I think that kind of solidified it," he said. "I enjoy my work too." Unfinished business for Grassley includes, in the short term, passing prescription drug price reform and getting help for cattle feeders who can't get a fair market price. Long term, he wants to make sure that Social Security and Medicare is available for younger generations. He said Democrats must take their very irresponsible spending spree off the table before Republicans will vote to increase the debt ceiling to prevent a government shutdown in the coming weeks. If they want to forget about the $3.5 trillion, they could get a bipartisan vote to extend the debt ceiling, Grassley said. Grassley has served in the Senate since 1981, holding major committee assignments and formerly serving as the chamber's second highest presiding officer. He famously has established the Full Grassley, a tour of 99 counties he makes every year. "Iowans know how seriously I take my work when representing them in the U.S. Senate to solve problems, which is why I never miss a vote," he added. Grassley will face a GOP primary challenge next year. State Senator Jim Carlin of Sioux City announced earlier this year that he's running for the U.S. Senate. Critics countered Grassley's homespun approach Friday with Progress Iowa Executive Director Matt Sinovic calling him a career politician who is trotting out a tired agenda. In his 19th run for public office, a career that has spanned time in Iowa House, the U.S. House, and the U.S. Senate. After 6 decades as a career politician, it's no shock that Senator Grassley wants to remain in office. Unfortunately, he has spent that time abandoning Iowa families, staining the Supreme Court with his petty partisan agenda, and living in the pocket of wealthy pharmaceutical companies while opposing Medicare and being able to negotiate more affordable drug prices, Sinovic said in a statement. Abby Finkenauer, one of the 3 Democrats currently seeking Grassley's seat, issued a statement saying that Grassley has changed during his time in Washington from an Iowa farmer to just another coastal elite. Now let's go on to Cavalcade of Color, Iowa's fall leaf show to looks to be a stunner. Autumn has arrived in Iowa. Lately, we've been experiencing perfect weather for leaf peeping, blue sky and sunshine days, and sweater weather nights. While traffic on Iowa's highways and country roads may not be bumper-to-bumper, looky-loos in Hawkeye State will find plenty of scenery to ooh and ah over. And if the weather holds, this autumn promises to be early and vibrant, said State Urban Forester Emma Hannigan from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Sumac, dogwood, and Virginia creepers have already started autumn colors show in northeast Iowa, dressed in scarlet, bittersweet, and butterscotch-colored leaves. Many maple, walnut, cottonwood, elms, and other trees, stressed out by summer drought and heat, are starting to drop their leaves. Other trees will soon be wearing their coats of many colors. In northeast Iowa, north central, and northwest Iowa, color is expected to peak between October 5th and 10th, according to DNR. Tree canopies are splatted with yellow and orange, chokeberries and are changing to yellow, or shades of red and purple, and sumacs are turning bright red in north central and northwest Iowa. Fall color in central Iowa will be at its best October 9th through 17th if predictions hold true, while west central and southwest Iowa should peak October 8th through 12th. South central, October 15th through 20th, and southeast Iowa, October 20th through 27th. Perfect autumn days occur more frequently in our memories than in real life, it said, but recent favorable weather is in our favor for a glowing season. These long, cool nights and sunny days are cues to trees that it's time to go into the mechanism of shutting down and sending the chlorophyll that makes its leaves green down to their roots for storage during dormancy, Hannigan said. Good weather encourages the development of red pigment and creates a greater buildup of sugars in the leaves, both vital for a great color show. When we see poor color years, it's because we've gotten a lot of rain or wind or strong winds that blow the leaves off trees, or we get an early hard freeze, she explained. Iowa's tree canopy has also been damaged by the derecho, tornadoes and other severe weather events. That translates into lots of new young trees being planted in the last 2 years, Hannigan said. The derecho, especially, has had a huge impact. With all this new planting, it's important to keep watering those trees right up to a hard freeze to give them the moisture they need, especially with the drought. And believe it or not, there's more to fall in Iowa than football and tailgating. Pumpkin patches and apple orchards are a great place to get a taste of autumn, and there are plenty of Oktoberfest celebrations and festivals. You'll find a mosaic of autumn scenery around the state. In northeast Iowa, hike and bike along Cedar Valley Nature Trails or through George Wythe State Park. Pikes Peak State Park is known for a panoramic view of the Mississippi River from its 500-foot bluff, the river valley and bridges connecting Iowa and Wisconsin. The Great River Road runs along the Muddy River with plenty of scenic overlooks. Backpack Trail at the Yellow River State Forest, or Harper's Ferry, was chosen as Iowa's best hiking trail by Outdoor Magazine several years ago. Include a water adventure and view fall colors from a canoe or kayak on the Upper Iowa River, accessible at Decorah, Bluffton, and Kendallville. The river, with its U-shaped bends and soaring limestone bluffs, was named one of the top 100 adventures in the U.S. by National Geographic Adventure magazine. In western Iowa, the Loess Hills are a natural wonder. Experience fall foliage from the top of the 45-foot-tall observation tower at Hitchcock Center in Honey Creek, or hike or ride the equestrian trails through prairies, valleys, and gorges at southwest Iowa's Wabunsee State Park on the Lewis and Clark Historic Trail. Ancient glaciers flattened the land in north-central Iowa, so visitors who climb Pilot Knob State Park and 1930s-era tower can see for miles. It's the second highest point in Iowa, and the park also has two lakes. Meander along the Iowa Great Lakes Trail and explore fall around Spirit Lakes, Okoboji, and Arnold's Park in northwestern Iowa. Iowa has 8 wine trails and 7 beer trails to satisfy a thirst for autumn adventure. Find information at www.iowabeer.org and www.iowawinetrail.com. Upcoming festivals and events include Oktoberfest in the Amana Colonies Friday through next Sunday, Waverly Oktoberfest Friday and Saturday, Great Iowa Fall Bike Ride by Ragbri Cedar Rapids October 2nd, Oktoberfest in the Quad Cities Rock Island, Illinois October 2nd, and Walk Waterloo October 6th Scenic Drive and Festival Kiowskwa and the Villages of Van Buren October 8th through 10th, and the Madison County Covered Bridge Festival Winterset October 9th through 10th. Now on to the article, at least 16 people indicated on gun charges in Waterloo and Cedar Falls sweep. Federal authorities have charged numerous Waterloo and Cedar Falls residents with gun crimes in a 2-day sweep. Following grand jury sessions in U.S. District Court for Northern Iowa and Cedar Rapids, at least 16 people were indicated on weapons offenses beginning Wednesday. Some appeared in court on Thursday, and others were slated to appear Friday. it wasn't immediately clear if any of the cases are connected, and many of those indicated had already been charged in state court in connection with the incidents. And recent firearm indictments include Jishan Tamar Robertson, 23, felon in possession of a firearm, possessed a 9mm Taurus G3 handgun, April 3rd. Robertson allegedly fired a handgun outside Club Legacy, 120 Sumner Street. Dewan Capri Campbell, Jr., 22, felon in possession of a firearm, possessed a .40 caliber Springfield XD pistol on March 29th. Edward Roby, Jr., 24, felon in possession of a firearm, possessed a 9mm Taurus 709's handgun, July 25th. Robby was found with a pistol and marijuana during a traffic stop. Terrence Earl Robby, Jr., 23, two counts of a felon in possession of a firearm, possessed a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson SD-40 handgun, March 29th, and a .40 caliber Kel-Tec sub-2000 rifle and a 9mm Smith & Wesson SW9VE handgun, July 8th. Police found the 9mm in a couch near his 2-year-old child and the rifle in a parked vehicle, and the .40 caliber was found during a traffic stop. Davin Terrell Biddle, 21, a drug user in possession of a firearm, possessed a 9mm Walther PPS handgun, March 29th. Blackhawk County deputies found the gun following a traffic stop and a brief pursuit. Biddle was also injured in the September 26, 2020 mass shooting at the Sin City Private Club that left two dead and injured several others. Alyssa Jo Stovall, 23, drug user in possession of a firearm, possessed a 9mm Ruger EC handgun and a 9mm SCCY CPX2 handgun in 2020 and 2021. Police found the SCCY handgun, marijuana, and THC gummies during a search of her West 9th Street apartment on July 22nd, according to court results. Now, let's move on to editorial. Don't let presidents start nuclear wars on their own. In the final days of Donald Trump's administration, General Mark Milley, the chairman of Joint Chief of Staff, ordered some very unusual instructions to senior military officials. If they received orders to launch an attack, up to and including the use of nuclear weapons, they were to do the process of consulting with him first. The general asked all of the officers to verbally signal their assent, which he reported considered an oath. That's according to a new book by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa. Milley had become so alarmed at Trump's addled behavior, the authors say that he felt the added safeguards were necessary to forestall a calamity. In issuing the orders, he knew full well that he was pulling a Schlesinger, or echoing the actions of Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger, who took similar measures to constrain an increasingly erratic Richard Nixon in 1974. Both incidents also highlighted a long-standing but largely unresolved danger, the lack of guardrails to prevent a reckless or unstable president from starting a nuclear war. Following the latest revelations, Republicans have accused Milley of everything from insubordination to treason. But whether he acted improperly is debatable. It's unclear if Milley was actually sought to usurp civilian control of the military, or as some critics charge, or merely urge the officials to keep him informed if they received any outlandish orders, a not unreasonable request at a time when the president appeared to be unhinged and much of the Pentagon's civilian leadership consisted of acting officials who had only spent weeks on the job. As it happens, there is no evidence that Trump was contemplating using nukes. But that doesn't mean that the world is safe from future presidents in similar situations. Under current policy, the commander-in-chief possesses sole authority to order a nuclear strike against an adversary at any time and place, although he or she would be expected to seek the advice of cabinet members and military leaders before issuing the order, so there's no requirement to do so. Once the president chooses from the list of attack options contained on the nuclear football, strikes could begin in a matter of minutes. Aside from the possibility that individual members of the military might refuse to carry out orders that deemed unlawful, there are no formal constraints on a president's ability to initiate a nuclear war. Such unrestricted power poses unacceptable risks. As commander-in-chief, the president should, of course, retain authority to take all necessary retaliatory measures if the U.S. were to come under nuclear attack. But stronger safeguards are needed to limit the danger of an unprovoked first use of such weapons. At a minimum, presidential order for a preemptive nuclear strike should be certified as authentic by the Secretary of Defense and reviewed by the Attorney General to determine its legality. The Vice President, as well as leaders of both parties in Congress, should be notified of the order. In theory, a president hellbent on using the bomb would still be able to ignore objections raised by other branches of government, but involving more elections and appointed officials in the process could delay hair-trigger action, buy time to consider less destructive options, and allow for more aggressive measures such as invoking the 25th Amendment to remove the president if necessary. Nuclear war, in Ronald Reagan's words, cannot be won and must never be fought. Since the start of the atomic age, every American president has accepted the grim logic of deterrence, but that may not always hold true. A more deliberate process for nuclear decision-making is necessary to protect the country and the world from the consequences of presidential miscalculation. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 26th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Florence A. Miller. Florence A. Miller, age 101, passed away Friday, September 24th, 2021, at Friendship Village Retirement Center. She was born on a farm in Humboldt, Iowa, January 29th, 1920, to George and Florence Munson Strachan. She graduated from high school at the age of 16 and traveled to Cedar Falls to attend college at the Iowa Normal School, now UNI, and then transferred to Iowa State University, where she graduated with a degree in home economics. After graduation, she began her teaching career in Jessup, Iowa, 1940 to 1944, and it was there she met her husband-to-be, Delbert Miller. They were married on July 14, 1943, in Columbia, after he enlisted in the Army, and then went off to participate in World War II. Florence returned to Humboldt to live with her parents and to work in the local bank, until Delbert returned from the war. Upon his return, they moved to Waterloo and began their family. Florence participated in many activities throughout her life in Waterloo. From 1965 to 1970, she was the activities director at Americana Nursing Home. She was past president of Waterloo Women's Club, 60-year member of Eastern Star, past president of Iowa State Women's Club, member of PEO Chapter JP, Friendship Village Foundation Board, Covenant Foundation Board, Covenant Auxiliary and Vintage Life Board, and the Waterloo Diplomats. She was a longtime member of the First United Methodist Church in Waterloo. She is survived by her two sons, Larry Miller of Hudsonville and Randy Miller of Clive, five grandchildren, Lisa Kaiser, Brent Miller, Ben Miller, Luke Miller, and Laura Miller, 10 great-grandchildren, Alyssa Kaiser, Kayla Kaiser, Anna Kaiser, Samantha Kaiser, Lydia Miller, Kayla Miller, Kelvin Miller, Lucy Miller, Reese Miller, and Riley Miller. Preceded in death by her parents, her husband Delbert, June 10, 1991, an infant son, Ronald Miller, and brothers Arthur, Opal, Paul, and Lyle Strachan. Burial will be at the Garden of Memory Cemetery in Waterloo. A private family-directed memorial service will be held at a later date. Arrangements by Locke Funeral Home. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralhome.com. Ellen Mae Anderson. Ellen Mae Anderson, 67, of Reedland, Iowa, passed away on Friday, September 24th at Unity Point Allen Memorial in Waterloo. Ellen was born on January 19, 1954, the daughter of Leo and Alinda Klemp. She was baptized in her parents' home shortly after birth and confirmed at St. Matthew's Lutheran Church. She was a 1972 graduate of Wapsie Valley High School. Ellen was united in marriage to Stefan Hans Andersen on November 27th, 1976, at St. Matthew's Lutheran Church in Reedland. Ellen worked at Santa Claus Industries from 1972 until 1978. Once the children were born, she became a stay-at-home farm wife. Ellen helped with various tasks on the farm and would later have various part-time jobs. Ellen loved to sew and over the years quilted many quilts. She enjoyed spending time outdoors with her dog and working in the garden. She devoted many years to the World Relief Schools Kit and the Shoebox Christmas Gifts. Spending time with her family was important to Ellen, especially her time with little Leo. Ellen is survived by her parents, Steve, a daughter, Audrey Hahn, a son, Brian Andersen, a grandson, Leo Robert Andersen, a sister, Doris Hartness. She was preceded in death by her parents. Funeral services will be held at 11 o'clock on Thursday, September 30th, 2021, at St. Matthew's Lutheran Church with the Reverend Dr. John Rabbery and Dr. Julie Andersen Schutt officiating. Burial will be held at in the St. Matthew's Lutheran Cemetery. Visitation will be held on Wednesday, 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Kaiser Korsen Funeral Home in Reedland and for 1 hour prior to services on Thursday at the church. Memorials may be directed to St. Matthew's Lutheran Church or to Unity Point Hospice. Online condolences may be left at www.kaisercorsen.com. Kaiser Korsen Funeral Home in Reedland is assisting the family with arrangements, and their phone number is 319-279-3551. Roy Jr. Cole. Roy Jr. Cole, 79, of Waterloo, died Thursday, September 21st, 2021, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, September 28th, 2021, at the Garden View Chapel with burial in the Garden of Memory Cemetery. Visitation will be held 1 hour before the service at Garden View Chapel. Graveside military rites will be conducted by the Becker Chapman American Legion Post 138 and the U.S. Navy Funeral Honor Detail. Memorials may be directed to the family. Garden View Chapel is in charge of arrangements, and their phone number is 319-232-2222. Online condolences may be left at www.carnesfuneralservice.com. Robert G. Evans. Bob was born May 27, 1937, in Cedar Falls, Iowa, the son of Robert F. and Dorothy Evans. He completed high school in Cedar Falls and served in the U.S. Air Force. Bob was united in marriage to Ann Beckham on December 6, 1962, at her parents' home in Panama, California. The couple resided in New Hartford from 1972 until Marty's passing and Bob's move to assisted living. Bob is survived by his sons, Robert D. Evans of Estes, Florida, Mark D. Side of Claremont, Florida, two grandchildren, Spencer Evans of Chicago, Illinois, and Sierra Evans of Waterloo, Iowa, one great-grandson, Zedekus Boxwell of Waterloo, Iowa, one brother, Gary Evans, and three sisters, Karen Katzenmeier, Pam Schneiderman, and Gina Leonard. Preceding Bob in death were his wife, parents, and three brothers, Steve, Larry, and Kent. A memorial and interment ceremony will be held October 16th at the United Methodist Church in New Hartford, Iowa, starting at noon. There will be a gathering after the service in the church fellowship hall from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. The family is asking, in lieu of flowers or gifts, that donations may be made to the United Methodist Church in New Hartford. Now, let's move over to the sports section, starting with Americans in historically great shape at Ryder Cup. The pressure and drama so typical of the Ryder Cup finally arrived on Saturday, with one big difference. The suspense was whether Europe could try to make a game of it. The Americans held their own over the final hour as Dustin Johnson completed a perfect week of team play and Scottie Scheffler delivered the biggest putt of his young career. That staked them to an 11-5 lead, their largest ever against Europe and their biggest in the Ryder Cup since 1975. No one has ever come back from more than a 4-point deficit in Ryder Cup history. That's the order facing Europe, which has yet to win a session at the Whistling Straits. The Europeans tried, getting another big win from John Ram and a clutch moment from Shane Lowry, who holed a 10-foot putt on the 18th green and was pumping his arm so furiously in celebration that he finally dropped his putter to the ground. So much was at stake, so little was gained. We're not in a good position, and it's going to take a beyond a monumental effort, said Ian Poulter, who has failed to deliver a point in 2 matches. So we need a couple of miracles. We're out there fighting as hard as we can, Lowry said. The Americans routed Europe again in foursomes Saturday morning, a third straight 3-1 margin to build a 9-3 lead, and while Europe was ahead in 3 of its afternoon 4 balls, Scheffler's 15-foot birdie putt on the 15th hole and his nifty up and down for a birdie on the next hole carried him and Brian DeChambeau to finish in the final match of the course. Next up is the final session of 12 single matches, historically an American strength. They need to reach 14.5 points to win back the gold trophy. I think we have a lot of guys on this team that really hate losing, and so individual matches tomorrow, I think that guys are going to be fired up and ready to play, Scheffler said, hopefully finishing this thing off. The U.S. team led 12-1/2-3, 1/2 going into Sunday in 1975, when playing against only Britain and Ireland, dating to the modern era of 1979 when continental Europe joined the party. Its largest lead was 10.5-5.5 in the 1981 Walton Heath. The 6-point lead ties the modern record in Europe set in 2004 at Oakland Hills in a record rout. Ram was unbeaten in the team play, the world's number one player looking every bit the part, teamed with Ryder Cup record setter Sergio Garcia to win foursomes in the morning, and then hold out to beat Brooks Koepka in the cold putting, Jordan Spieth in 4-ball. Right when it looked as though the Americans might square the match, Ram made a 30-foot birdie on the 16th hole, and Spieth missed from 12 feet, the sixth time in the 4 balls he missed from that range, or closer, including one that mysteriously circled the entire cup and came out. Even so, the climb is steeper than some of the wild dunes dotting the landscape of this rugged terrain along the Lake Michigan shores. The top 5 players in the world have gone 15-0-2 in team play at this Ryder Cup. The problem for Europe is 4 of those players are Americans. Johnson became the first American since Larry Nelson in 1979 to go 4-0 in team play. He went out twice with Colin Morikawa, the 2-time major champion who drove the 6th green and delivered plenty of big putts his own in the afternoon 4 balls. Johnson was the only American to play all 4 matches. A 9-3 lead through these sessions made it easy for U.S. captain Steve Stricker to rest Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay, who won another foursomes match, and Justin Thomas, who delivered another clutch shot in the par 5 16th to set up a foursome win with Spieth. The goal for the Americans after their best opening day in 46 years was to wipe the slate clean and play as though the Ryder Cup was just starting. For a time, it started to feel as if the Ryder Cup was over. Johnson and Morikawa never trailed in either of their 2 matches. Schauffele and Cantlay flipped their match during a 6-hole stretch in the middle of their round. Spieth and Thomas rallied from an early 3-down deficit, already the leading point scorer in Ryder Cup history. Garcia won both his matches with Ram, the latest European and version of a Spanish Armada. He has won 25 matches, breaking the record held by Nick Faldo. What we did is not enough, not with the situation we're in, Garcia said after his morning foursomes match. It felt better in the afternoon, a board finally filled with mostly European blue, but when it ended, Europe had not made any ground from the morning. Next on to Hawkeyes have to rally past Colorado State. Spencer Petras threw for 224 yards and 2 touchdowns, and number 5 Iowa needed a second half comeback to defeat Colorado State 24-14 on Saturday. The Hawkeyes, 4-0, won their 10th consecutive game, the program's longest streak since winning 12 in a row to open the 2015 preseason. Iowa has also has a 15-game non-conference winning streak, the longest current streak in the nation. It wasn't easy. I think our guys were trying today, and we had practiced well, said Iowa coach Kirk Fertinez, but it just wasn't clicking for us. Colorado State, 1-3, led 14-7 at halftime, but the Hawkeyes scored touchdowns on back-to-back possessions and took a combined 4 plays in the third quarter. A fumble recovery by Iowa linebacker Jack Campbell and the Colorado State's 6-yard line set up a touchdown run by wide receiver Tyrone Tracy Jr. on the next play that tied the game. Petras threw a 27-yard touchdown pass to tight end Sam Laporta on the next possession to give Iowa a 21-14 lead. At halftime, we're behind and not playing great, Fertinez said. A lot of that was our own doing, but our guys rallied and just kept playing. Petras said the Hawks' comeback was gritty. We're down by 7 at half, but I thought we kept fighting, and it wasn't pretty, but that's football, he said. That's going to happen. I'm really happy and proud of our team for bouncing back and coming out with a win. Campbell, who had 18 tackles, led Iowa's defense, which held Colorado State at just 32 yards in 19 plays in the third quarter. It's just about never giving up on a play, no matter how far down the field it is, Campbell said. The Hawkeyes have a streak of 26 executive games in which they have held their opponents to 24 points or less, the longest current streak among Power 5 schools. We knew we were playing an elite defense, Colorado State coach Steve Adazio said. We knew yards were going to be hard to come by. Petras, who had a 43-yard touchdown pass to freshman receiver Keegan Johnson in the first half to give Iowa a 7-0 lead, had his streak of 23 quarters without an interception end in the second quarter when Colorado State cornerback Robert Floyd wrestled away a pass intended for Tracy and returned it 62 yards. That set up Todd Sentio's 3-yard touchdown pass to Gary Williams. Colorado State held Iowa to just 54 rushing yards and 32 carries. You can't stop the run better than that, Adazio said. Said Colorado State tight end Trey McBride, who led the Rams with 6 catches for 59 yards, it hurts. This was a team we should have beat. Kind of a subheader, it says the takeaway. The Hawkeyes, who had 179 yards in the first half, but could only get 7 points, showed that they could come back from their early issues as they got back into Big Ten play next weekend at Maryland. I'm happy we won, but don't get me wrong, Campbell said. We've got a lot of things that we can get better at. And now on to Iowa's decision, Jets girls wrestling movement at state level forward. Wow, Thursday was a big day for the sport of women's wrestling. When University of Iowa wrestling coach Tom Brands and Iowa Director of Athletics Gary Barta announced that Iowa would be the first Power 5 school to add women's wrestling as a varsity sport, it was a monumental moment. Women's wrestling was growing. Let's clarify that statement a little better. Women's wrestling had been surging into prominence for quite some time. In 2020, the NCAA recognized women's wrestling as an emerging sport in all three of its divisions, which is precursor to be fully sanctioned. There are 45 intercollegiate women's wrestling programs at NCAA institutions, and more than 35 NAIA programs and a handful of NJCAA programs. 5 programs in the state of Iowa have five programs in the state of Iowa have programs. Grandview University, Iowa Wesleyan University, Simpson University, Waldorf University, and William Penn University. Iowa is the third Division I program to announce its joining Presbyterian and Sacred Heart University. Barta's decision is huge because there are a few names that equal Iowa's national recognition in the sport of wrestling, and the announcement by Iowa was not made in a rush. Frankly, Tom Brands was in my ear three, four, or five years ago saying, "Come on, boss, let's go. Let's get the women's wrestling added," Barta said Thursday. We were not ready to do that yet, but we were watching it. Another trend also caught Barta's eye. In the last decade, more women than men are going to college. That's not an Iowa thing or a Midwest thing, but a national thing. During that same time span, Brands and the Iowa Wrestling Program were in the middle of a major fundraising effort to build a $20 million standalone wrestling facility. Construction on that building will begin in 2022. BARDA admitted yesterday that 2 years ago, Iowa intentionally included women's facilities in that training center with foresight that Iowa would be adding women's wrestling. Congratulations, Iowa. You have now lit the spark of what could be an explosion of another major Division I wrestling programs following suit. That gets me to the question I'm asked most often, in what will be, that is, when will the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union follow course? That there has been a major grassroots effort to convince IGHSAU that the time is now. I've talked to IGHSAU, the executive director, John Berger, casually about this on multiple occasions. Berger has seen most of the states around Iowa and their athletic associations sanction the sport. She has witnessed the growth of Iowa wrestling coaches and official associations' girls' state wrestling teams explode from a little more than 100 participants to more than 600 girls participating in wrestling last season. The third IWCOA state tournament was a major event at the new Extreme Arena in Coralville. She didn't miss that fact. But Berger has been consistent within her message to the grassroots efforts to get girls wrestling sanctioned by the IGHSAU. In order to get the process to start, the IGHSAU needs 50 letters from schools across the state of Iowa stating that they will sponsor girls wrestling. The most reluctant number released in Iowa in the IGHSAU has 32 of those letters. Waverly Shellrock head coach Eric Whitcomb has been a leading voice in the movement. He was extremely excited about Iowa's announcement. "I think it's huge," Whitcomb said. "You look at, obviously, there is enough movement around the entire country now. You have the largest institutions, post-secondary schools, trying to get involved with the sport of women's wrestling. That is not something schools of that size are going to jump on if they don't see the growth there. They don't see the growth there to where it will really emerge as something big. I'm not saying this to downplay the 99 other collegiate programs who have done their part, but to get a program with the magnitude of the University of Iowa sends an entirely different message." Whitcomb also believes that the announcement is even a bigger deal on the state level. "Being from Iowa and having the University of Iowa be the first school of its size to do this, to make that announcement is exciting," Whitcomb says. "And obviously, for the people involved with that movement here in Iowa, especially myself as one of the leading voices, it is really encouraging. If you want to think about the two biggest moves in the state of Iowa as far as girls wrestling, one, the IWCOA state tournament getting started 3 years ago, and now the Iowa Hawkeyes adding women's wrestling." Whitcomb continued with his plea to schools in the state of Iowa, in particular those of similar size to Waverly Shellrock and bigger. "Currently, of the 32 letters support sent to IGHSAU, only Ames, Boone, Carlisle, Clear Lake, Clear Creek, Amana, Iowa City High, Ottumwa, Cedar Rapids, Prairie, Waukee, Waverly Shellrock, and Council Bluffs, Lewis, Central are the 3A schools. There are more than 50 3A schools who have notes sent in letters. Just 3A schools alone could get the ball rolling at the state level," Whitcomb said. "When that happens, the smaller schools will start having conversations on how do we bring our school districts into the fold, and how some sharing agreements could help field entire programs. When that happens, then we are really going to start seeing things develop. Maybe Iowa's announcement will get Berger and the IGHSAU to rethink their position." Brands have put it most bluntly Thursday when he was asked about the girls wrestling in the Iowa high school level. "I think that the state of Iowa is a no-brainer," Brands said. "I know that there are people in this room that are working hard. Let's not skirt the issue. There's a little squabble going on who's going to own it, which organization. Get over that squabble. You know what? Partner up. Let's get some common sense here and get a high school tournament level for these girls. They've earned it enough. They need it. Frankly, girls wrestling as an IGHSAU sanctioned sport is going to happen. When? Probably not tomorrow, but most definitely it is coming, and hopefully in the very near future. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 26th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.